It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. The UW-Platteville community is reckoning with the tragic shooting that claimed the lives of two students in a campus residence hall on Monday.
Police are investigating the incident as a murder-suicide. Just days after graduation, as many students were preparing to return home.
The university is providing additional counseling services to help students cope. They've partnered with a Waukesha-based mental health provider called Empathia to support the existing services on campus.
Michelle Colosimo is Empathia's Executive Director of Critical Support Services, and she joins us now to discuss what the response looks like and how her team is helping students through this difficult time. Michelle, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Good morning.
Can you explain what the role Empathia has here and how this partnership with UW-Platteville is working?
Sure. So as an organization, we are called in when there are large-scale critical events that occur to be able to support the organization in navigating the response, as well as supporting those individuals impacted by that response to find hope and healing in the most difficult times in their life.
Okay, so your team gets called in. What do you do first?
So when we get receive the immediate call, we provide guidance and consultation to the organization engaging our services. And then we deploy on site to begin putting a plan in place on how we are going to support those that were impacted by that event.
And what does that support system look like now as we talk? What is happening?
Sure. So initially, when we came on site, it was all about immediate support. When you are looking at situations that are like this, people, it's not your traditional counseling. People are trying to make sense of something that seems that's hard to make sense of, as well as to process the feelings that they're experiencing because they've maybe never experienced these feelings before. So we come on site to meet with groups of students and faculty and staff to just help them process and normalize those reactions, as well as meet with individuals one-on-one who might need some additional support beyond that.
But this came also right at the end of the year, just after graduation. It must be a lot quieter campus as students have gone away, have gone home.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. It was right at the end of the school year, and that was an important aspect of this. It was ensuring that services were in place on campus, but for those students who left and went home, we need to ensure that they had support as well. So we did establish a toll-free line for students and faculty and staff who weren't on campus to speak directly with a counselor to receive immediate support. And then in addition to that, the campus has contracted with Mantra for ongoing counseling support that students can receive from any place that they're located in.
Can you explain what Mantra is?
Mantra is a behavioral health organization that provides counseling services to students within an institution.
In terms of calling a toll-free line to talk, what is uptake like on that? Do people do that?
Yeah, I think you can definitely see a response from engaging in that type of setup, that you have to give people options. And so some aren't going to want to be on campus. Some don't want to be seen face to face. Some are just having questions that they just really need to talk through right now. And that's where you see the engagement via toll-free number is really. So if you're kind of having those questions or that doubt, or maybe it's the middle of the night and you can't sleep and you're wondering if this is normal, that's where you're seeing engagement with the call center itself.
Do the mental health counselors at UW-Platteville who are offering counseling services at this time, do they need support as well? What does that counseling look like?
Yes. We talk about supporting the caregivers, right? Those who are supporting others. Because if you're not caring for yourself, it's going to be much harder than to support those around you who are impacted. So it is absolutely important to make sure that support is put in place for those individuals, that there's opportunity to be able to just debrief with what they're experiencing, and just also to talk through and remind each other about what are those healthy coping mechanisms that we have to rely on to reengage, to ensure that we're continuously filling our own cups.
We're talking about mental health services available to UW-Platteville students and the larger community after Monday's tragic shooting on campus. We have Michelle Colosimo with us, Executive Director of Critical Support Services for Empathia. That's a Waukesha company that helps organizations recover from a crisis. Michelle, you know, we've talked about the direct counseling for those affected. How much of this is about helping with crisis management and response as well? Is that part of this?
It is. It is just as important as well as providing support services. You know, most institutions or organizations never experience anything like this. And so it can be hard to know what to do, what is the right thing, what are things that we need to be looking for, what are things that we need to be planning for, because it can be really overwhelming. And the goal is to transition from chaos to control as quickly as possible. And that's really where we're coming in from, that crisis management and response side, to really help the organization navigate that.
What are some of the big emotions people might be processing? You talked about not being able to sleep. What are some of the emotions that are coming up?
I would, you know, what you're seeing in response to this particular event, as common with others similar to this, is anxiety, fear, hypervigilance, sadness. Those are going to be very common and normal for somebody to experience when something like this happens on their campus or wherever they are located.
How do you enter a community like Platteville as an outsider and find ways to connect with the community and make them feel comfortable very, very quickly?
It's a great point. It's really about creating safe spaces for people to come to. And it goes back to the comment I made earlier about having many different options for people to choose from. And so for those who may have not experienced talking with a counselor before, there were places that were created on campus for students to come together to be with one another, because that sense of community is so important. And in those spaces, we had our counselors as well as therapy dogs to just engage in conversation. And as you're engaging in that conversation, then that's where people have a tendency then to open up more and just start talking about, you know, what it's been like for them. We're really just asking those questions to get the conversation going. And as part of that, and as they're talking and processing, then we're also just talking with them about what it is that is normal, and what, you know, and that what they're feeling is normal, as well as most people have had difficult times in their lives, not to this degree, but helping them identify what got them through that in the past and what can they tap into to help them through it with this particular event. It's all about building resilience. Most people are resilient even in the most traumatic situations.
You bring therapy dogs with you. Can you talk about their role?
Sure. And just a point of clarification, we didn't bring the therapy dogs.
Oh, okay.
But yes. So the campus had therapy dogs already on campus as just part of their normal services. And then additional therapy dogs came on site. And I have to speak very positively of that. It creates a level of comfort for people who may just sitting down face to face talking to somebody may not engage. But if you're, you know, cuddling with a dog and petting the dog and talking, it becomes more natural and comfortable. And so it's just a great way to connect with others in an environment that feels more comfortable for them.
What is it like for you in your work to have to jump from crisis to crisis and perhaps seeing some really troubling parts of society all the time as part of the job?
It's difficult work, but I have to say that I am blessed to be able to be pulled into these events. And what keeps me going is really helping people know that there's hope, that you can get through this, even though it may seem really difficult. And just that little bit of holding on to that hope and helping people know that that this will get better is all the impact and positive impact that keeps me continuing to go and support and help those in need.
Michelle, how long will Empathia stay involved with UW-Platteville?
Really until they no longer need us. So we really come in because a lot of times in the beginning, it's just very overwhelming for the outpour of need. And that's where we're stepping in. Institutions already have services in place that they've had in place prior to. Mm-hmm. So once you start to see the uptick decrease and to a more manageable pace, that's typically where we transition out. Sometimes, though, the school or the organization might just still keep us engaged just to be able to consult, as they're preparing or planning for things. So as an example, go ahead.
Very quickly, I have to say goodbye, but thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, you're so welcome, and thank you for having me.
Michelle Colosimo is Executive Director of Critical Support Services for Empathia.
Coming up, new CDC numbers show a drop in opioid deaths. A Wisconsin emergency physician says that's good news, but there's still work to be done.
Yes, we've seen a reduction, but we have to remember that 80,000 people a year still are dying.
That's next here on Wisconsin Today.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Last year, overdose deaths dropped by about 30,000 nationwide compared to the previous year, a decrease of nearly 30%. That's from data released this month by the CDC.
Overdose deaths went down across every category that the CDC tracks, including opioids and methamphetamine.
Wisconsin had among the biggest drops in the nation percentage-wise, with 36% fewer deaths.
The numbers are the lowest they've been since before the pandemic.
Dr. Chris Eberline is an emergency room doctor at Gunderson by Amplify in La Crosse and co-founder of Alliance to Heal, a group in La Crosse that helps people suffering from opioid addiction. Dr. Eberline, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Now, before we get into these statistics, the trends and numbers, I want to remember that these are people we're talking about. You work in a community, you see the impact on people and their loved ones. Can you talk about the toll this opioid addiction has had on people you've worked with over the years?
Yeah. This has been something that has impacted just about everyone I know of knows someone that's been impacted by either an overdose or an overdose death. And, yes, we have some celebration with a reduction in opioid overdose deaths, but we are still losing 80,000 people a year in this country. This has been ongoing for a couple decades now.
And when I look at the numbers over the years in Wisconsin and around the United States, again, this big improvement in 2024 over the previous year. But if we rolled back and looked at pre-2019, that would still look like a pretty bad year, right? We're not, by any stretch of the imagination, out of the woods here.
For sure we're not. We're basically still double where we were in the 2013-2014 range. So yes, it's still having an enormous impact on our communities.
And these numbers include all overdose deaths. So that would include methamphetamine and cocaine, maybe even prescription medications. But correct me if I'm wrong, what's driven the big increase in overdose deaths and is the thing that's really driving the story is opioids and fentanyl in particular in the last few years. Do I have that right?
You do. Yeah, it has been the driving force in a lot of the increase over the last few years has been the illicit synthetic opioids, and fentanyl being the primary one, yes.
Now, looking at this good news, this big drop in 2024, there are a lot of possible explanations I've seen floated out there. What, given your firsthand perspective and your wider look at these, what stands out to you as things that may have helped drive that news?
It's really important to look at this. I don't think we're going to see one thing mm-hmm. that has driven all of it, right? But I do think we're starting to see the additive effect of multiple things that we've done. One, I think that's been really important is that increased access to naloxone, Narcan. The distribution has been wide of that. From anecdotal and personal experience with patients I see in the EMS system I lead, this has really made a big impact, saving hundreds of lives a year in our community alone. And then, you couple that with some other things that we've done, the expanded addiction treatment, really pivotal as well, expanding, starting to utilize some of the virtual care options has been bringing care to the people that need them, especially in our rural communities that don't always have access to a substance abuse counselor or mental health resources that you do in the larger areas. So you're starting to get that expansion of care out. So that's been really important. We've expanded our medication assisted treatment options, easier access for buprenorphine and increased provider availability to prescribe that has been pivotal. And then, we've a lot of other education, some of our public health initiatives, the prevention efforts, the fentanyl test strips have been important. All of these kind of coupled together has been really pivotal in getting these numbers down. And like I said, I don't think you're going to be able to point at one thing and say, that's the magic ticket right there. But when you start to add these up, we're starting to see this shift. Finally, it's been years of work, but we're starting to see that shift.
I want to pick apart a few of those things you just listed, starting with the drugs that help prevent death when an overdose happens, naloxone and the like. How have we done at getting those kind of drugs where they're needed to the people who need them so that they can use them in that moment that it's a life or death situation?
Yeah, and when I look at that, so we've done a few things. One, we've made it so EMS fire agencies can leave Narcan behind at scenes. That's something in Wisconsin we weren't able to do until about 2019 due to some laws that were on the books. And then the over-the-counter Narcan, so more distribution. But I think the thing that really made a difference was when the Narcan Direct program, because all these programs, Narcan's an expensive drug. You're talking $40 to $80 a dose, and these agencies just would not be able to give it out for free like they have been to get it to people if we didn't have programs to support that. So that has been instrumental in getting Narcan distributed, and that's something that we have to make sure that we continue to do, or we will see these overdose deaths go up again. So Narcan has been really, really important. And I think we've done a good job of reaching where it needs to go. And a lot of that is some of the public health work that they've done, looking at areas, and we've done heat maps. Where are these overdoses occurring? How can we get Narcan to the people that need it the most? and educate them on how to use it.
One concern I've seen raised about the Narcan part of the solution here is, okay, well, they are alive still, and that's great, but they're still addicted. They may be in this situation again tomorrow or next week or next month. How do we take that good news, we save that life, and then take it the next step to help someone start dealing with that addiction?
To me and most people in this field, I think, you know, really the goal is we need to keep someone alive long enough to pursue treatment. And they may not be ready to pursue treatment today, but tomorrow they may be. But if they're dead from their overdose, we can't get them there. And so it's really important to make sure people have the resources so they can stay alive long enough until that day is right for them. And that's one of the things we've really focused on, and it's made a big impact. There are a lot, and I like to remind people, there are a lot of members of our communities that have been addicted to opiates and have recovered, are in recovery, and are productive members of society. You know, these are not people that should be written off. These are people that we should take care of and we should continue to support. They're our friends and family members. And so, the stigma, we've fought that for a long time. And I do believe that we've made huge strides in that. Are there still members of society that think that we shouldn't be doing some of these programs? Absolutely, there are. But we have to continue to work in proving to them that this is, this is something that works, that saves lives, and the lives are worth saving.
I want to hammer that point home, because I think also even in my own mind, there's a part of me that thinks, oh, somebody's addicted to opioids. That's going to be forever for them. It's impossible to get out of. Except I know factually, I know people who used to be addicted and now don't use those substances. There are treatments. They can work. It may not be easy, but there is hope for people to get out of opioid addiction. Can you talk about that a little more?
Yeah, there is hope. Like any addiction, it's a lot of work. You need support. You know, we've got good treatment programs, and there are many, many success stories of patients that have that are in recovery from this and, leading good, productive, healthy lives.
We're talking to Dr. Chris Eberlein, emergency room doctor at Gunderson by Amplify in La Crosse, co-founder of Alliance to Heal, a group in La Crosse that helps people suffering from opioid addiction. We're looking at a new data out from the CDC showing a big drop in overdose deaths last year compared to the previous year. Still high numbers, though, if we compare it to, say, 10 years ago. Dr. Eberlein, there were efforts over the course of the pandemic, I think in particular, to fund public health interventions, the Narcan we were talking about, but also some of the treatment you were talking about. Is that something you think may have helped move the needle?
For sure. You know, all of these programs that we have been working on, these programs were not done without good oversight and science behind them. The continuation of these programs is important because, we still are losing 80,000 people a year in this country. We have not by any means won this battle. You know, we have had significant progress, but there is always a risk of backsliding if we're not careful on this.
Anything involving federal funding these days, there are concerns of whether it's going to continue in the months and years to come. Are there programs receiving federal funding that you would be particularly worried about losing?
Yeah, I think any of these sorts of programs that are working towards education, the Narcan programs, needle exchange is important. Many of these programs, yes, there's initial cost. However, the downstream cost of not doing it is much, much higher. And we really have to, it's similar. It's very analogous to some of our behavioral health costs. A little bit of prevention saves enormous amounts of money downstream. And so it's really important that we are careful when we evaluate these programs to what, we may save a dollar today by eliminating this, but it's going to cost us hundreds of dollars in the future for each dollar saved. Be really cognizant of that and make intelligent choices on where these sorts of cuts come so we don't end up in a much worse situation than we are even today.
I want to get to another factor some people have pointed to, and that's on the supply side. Some notions from people who study drugs around the country that things involving fentanyl and other synthetic opioids, for whatever reason, as they come into the United States, may be less potent and maybe are finding their ways into fewer drug combinations. That's a harder thing to track, I believe, but is that something you've seen or heard about out there?
The potency is really hard to track because, you know, it's coming in a relatively pure form, and then they're splitting it and cutting it up as it comes closer to the end user. And so much of it depends on how it is split and distributed as it gets out into the communities. So it is really hard to get good concrete data on that, to be honest with you. So that is something... You know, like so much of this opiate epidemic, you know, good data is sometimes hard to come by. And it's really important that we continue to work at finding ways to look at the impacts that the epidemic is having, the numbers of deaths and overdoses, but also our programs that we're using to combat it. That data has been incredibly important. Although sometimes incomplete and not always, catching every facet of information that we need, but without it, we really have no guidance on which way to go.
Speaking of the presence of fentanyl in drugs, you mentioned earlier the test is it test strips that people could use.
Correct.
to see, hey, is there fentanyl in this drug, whether it's an opioid or not. Talk us through how that works and if it seems like it's been effective, if people have said, OK, I'm not going to take this now because it turned up positive for fentanyl.
Yeah, we're definitely seeing that. And especially as we've distributed the strips, you know, we have seen an increase in the number of other drugs that have been laced with fentanyl as this has continued on. In part because, you know, fentanyl in compared to some other drugs was even cheaper, and so it was being mixed in with it. And so there are people that have lives have been saved by testing and realizing that the thing you thought you were getting is not what you're getting. The fentanyl test strip does not give you potency. You know, it's like pregnancy test, positive, negative. There is no in between necessarily. So you really have to make sure that, it's the test strips are being used correctly. But when they are used correctly, it is really helping us.
Now, we focus mostly on opioids today. Looking at this national CDC data, yes, opioid overdose deaths went down, but so did overdose deaths for methamphetamine, cocaine, just kind of across the board, really. What do you see driving drops in overdose deaths from those other drugs?
Yeah, I think there's a couple things happening. One, I think we've done a really good job with education on how dangerous some of these substances are. And, you know, there is, you know, unfortunately, as time goes on, people know others that have died from this and are much more careful about what they're doing. And then when you start giving people more tools like the fentanyl test strips to test these other drugs, it makes them much more cautious on what they're taking, which is also helpful. So I think you are seeing a little bit of a shift in drug use patterns as well from this. But once again, it's all a little early to me to really tell. You know, that's one thing when these numbers started to come out in the last, you know, 6 months to a year, really cautious optimism is what I would, for those of us working on this nearly every day is kind of what we have.
A misconception that I think I tend to have, Dr. Eberline, is that, okay, this person might be an opioid drug user and this person is methamphetamine and so on. But there are definitely some people who are generally addicted and they'll use whatever might be available. So maybe if we're treating them because they showed up for one medication or one drug, it might be helping them avoid that other drug too. Is there something to that?
Yeah, I think there is. I absolutely, you know, we've seen a lot of polysubstance overdose deaths as well. So people are using cocktails of drugs. And I think you're continuing to see that. And it's making people, it's harder to treat when you have multiple addictions, but we are still getting these people into treatment as well, which is important.
Finally, accessibility and affordability, Dr. Eberlein. If someone in your community has a problem with addiction, they're at that place where they feel like they're ready to try to fix this and they want to seek help, how easy is it for them to find that help in a timely way, in a way that they can afford?
Yeah, I think, and this is where we've made really large improvements. Locally, I can speak to that the best. Between the local hospital systems expanding medication-assisted treatment and counseling, as well as the county helping people navigate it, and then you've got independent groups that have started that treatment program. So it has really expanded our options. So it's really been helpful from that standpoint. And we've seen a lot more treatment options. There's been a lot more funding for treatment. In the past, there was time where the county would run out of treatment about halfway through the year, and they didn't know what to do with people beyond that. And it was really a problem. So continuation of funding to get people into treatment is going to be really critical moving forward. Like I said, we don't want to end up sliding backwards on this because we make poor choices in how and what we fund on this.
Dr. Eberlein, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Dr. Chris Eberlein is an emergency room doctor at Gunderson by Amplify in La Crosse and co-founder of Alliance to Heal. That's a La Crosse group helping people suffering from opioid addiction. He was with us for a look at last year's decrease in overdose deaths nationwide and here in Wisconsin. For disclosure, Amplify Health is a business sponsor of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up, 8 Chinese men were on board the Titanic when disaster struck. One of the survivors ended up in Wisconsin. A new book tells their story.
I'm glad that we were able to restore the dignity of these men who had been maligned for more than a century.
Meet the author and the son of a Titanic survivor, coming up on Wisconsin Today.
You're listening to Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Tyler Ditter with a story about a relationship cut short by war. We're sharing it just ahead of Memorial Day.
Some people that we meet might only be in our lives momentarily, but they can have a profound effect on us that can last a lifetime. Jeffrey Saunders, a private first class in the 101st Airborne Division of the U.S. Army, had that effect on Adriana Bonowitz. She shared her experience as part of StoryCorps' Military Voices initiative, which is made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
My name is Leonora Adriana Rosado Bonowitz. I'm in Libertyville, Illinois. I was 16 years old, and my mother sent me to my uncle's house in Miami during a vacation period. During this vacation, my cousin invited me to a party. And I met this young man from Jamaica. He lived there and had come also to Miami to visit his mother and sister. He was American citizen only in paper. His mother had registered him at the American embassy when he was born, but he grew up in Jamaica and was Jamaican in his heart. This was sometime during the Vietnam War. And because he was registered as an American citizen, he was called to the service. He was, I believe, 18 or 19 years old. So we met during that vacation. Then he got his draft papers. Before he was shipped to Vietnam, he wrote to me and said, I want to come visit you in Mexico, which he did. And after he visited me, he went off to Vietnam. During a year, he wrote every time he could. I had a bunch of letters, which I kept And in these letters, he would include photographs or mementos that he would get on a mission. He would arrive into a village and there would be empty houses, and he would pick up these little mementos, which he sent to me. And I kept all that for all these years. A year later, I received a telegram from the American Embassy telling me he had been killed. He died the death of a hero. The Viet Cong had thrown a grenade in the midst of the group where he was with his fellow soldiers, and he threw himself over the grenade to save them. And I also received a letter from his mother telling me how much he loved me and how sad it was that what he wanted to do, which was to marry me after he returned, that would never happen. So with the grief of having lost, I wouldn't have called him my boyfriend, but a friend. I carried that all these years until 2 years ago. A friend of mine asked me about that box of letters that I've been keeping for ages. And he said, but that's a shame that you just have them in a box and nobody knows this story. Well, coincidentally, I had found out that there is in Chicago the Pritzker Military Library and Museum. So I copied all the letters and then I took everything to the Pritzker Military Library. He was a wonderful young man. And really the story of a very young life that was cut super short. He had to grow up so quickly in the face of all the danger in Vietnam for a country that he really didn't know. And he certainly would not have gone into the army if he hadn't been compelled to.
That was Adriana Bonowitz of Libertyville, Illinois. She shared her experience as part of StoryCorps' Military Voices Initiative, which is made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Tyler Ditter.
This is Wisconsin Today.
Over 2,000 people were on the Titanic in 1912. Only 712 survived the disaster. Among them were six Chinese people, and one ended up in Wisconsin.
The Chinese survivors were attacked in the press for false claims that they took places in lifeboats reserved for women and children. Barred by the Chinese Exclusion Act, none of the Chinese survivors were legally allowed onto U.S. soil.
Fong Wing Sun hoisted himself out of the frigid North Atlantic waters onto a piece of wood until he could be rescued. Fong later lived in Milwaukee. He passed away in 1986.
A new book shares the story of Fong and the other survivors. The author is speaking in Wisconsin next week, along with Tom Fong, the son of Fong Wing Sun. They both join us now.
Tom Fong owns the Cozy Inn in Janesville, and Stephen Schweinkert is the author of The Six, the untold story of the Titanic's Chinese survivors. Stephen, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And Tom, thanks for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Tom, let's start with you. Your father was one of, if not the last people rescued after the sinking of the Titanic. Growing up here in Wisconsin, did you know about the story? Did he talk about this experience growing up?
I only heard this story from one of his friend's daughter when I was like about eight or nine years old. I heard this story about him being rescued from the waters, but there's never mentioning of what ship, because I always assumed it was in China. So I didn't learn about this till about 2003.
What tipped you off that there was this, you know, famous connection to your dad on the Titanic, and what started you pursuing the story, Tom?
Well, as a child, I heard the story about him being rescued from the waters, that he was floating on a door, and at first he was clinging onto a corpse. That's what I heard as a child. Then somehow he managed to find this piece of wood that he climbed, debris, and he fastened himself. And that was all I heard. But then later on, back in 2003, my cousin just happened to come to to Wisconsin. He lived out in California. So he mentioned that my father's on the Titanic, which I didn't believe at first. And then later on that evening, we're sitting having dinner, and then his father, and he knew the date of the Titanic sinking, and that sort of threw me for a loop, sort of pricked my ears up like, wait a sec, how would he know the date? And then late that evening, my son Googled, looking for passenger names lists, and there he found my father's story about clinging onto this piece of debris that I heard as a child.
Now, Stephen, that's Tom's family history that he was learning about. You were researching this. Can you set the stage for us? We've got this Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882. It's in effect. It says, hey, Chinese people under most circumstances can't come to the United States. Tom's father was on the Titanic coming to the U.S. along with seven other people from China. What brought them on the Titanic?
The Chinese men that were on Titanic, there are a lot of misconceptions about them. Many people thought that they were stowaways. Many people thought that they were part of Titanic's crew. Neither of those is correct. They were fare-paying passengers on Titanic, even though the Chinese Exclusion Act was in effect. Their employer, the Donald Steamship Line, was, today we would call it seconding. They were being seconded over from the work that they were doing on ships in around the United Kingdom and in Europe. They were being sent over to work on the American ships that the same steamship line operated. They were sailors. They were mariners. They were, these were men that worked in engine rooms, maybe occasionally as cooks, certainly not as stewards, and certainly not as officers. Strangely enough, their voyage on Titanic was probably one of the first real pleasure cruises that they ever had.
And Stephen, talk us through Wing Sun's experience when the Titanic hit the iceberg. What do we know about how he was able to survive?
So one thing that I think the Chinese men did correctly on the night of the sinking, and the reason that accounts for their high survival rate, out of the eight of them that were on board Titanic, six of them survived. Their familiarity with ships, because they did work on them, I think that helped them a lot. And then also, you know, in the late stages of Titanic sinking, when almost all of them were still on board Titanic, they made a counterintuitive decision. And that was, instead of going for the seeming high ground, which would have been the stern that was rising at an increasing angle, but seemed to be higher and safer than being close to the waterline, they actually made a decision to go toward the waterline. Either they saw that collapsible lifeboats were being assembled there, or maybe they just thought that there was more chance that they would be able to get off down there. And certainly in the case of four of the six men, they got into one of the last lifeboats to leave from the starboard side. They got into collapsible lifeboat C. Tom's father was not nearly as lucky. He and two companions ended up in the water. And unfortunately, only Tom's father was able to survive. The other two perished.
Tom, Stephen writes that he met with you, I think, in Janesville to share the story. What was it like working with Stephen and finding out how much of this story about your father was true and learning more about this thing that he never talked about?
Well, the strange thing was when we first started the project, I just wanted to know his past, basically, and find out the truth about his past, because he never spoke about it. In fact, I was sort of skeptical if they could actually find anything, because this was like so long ago, and I wasn't sure if, you know, what were the record keeping like. And so I was really surprised when Stephen would come and talk to me once in a while, or Arthur Jones. And they gave me little tidbits and like little teasers, like what was going on. And then I was really surprised when the final project finally finished. They did an amazing job.
Stephen, one of the obstacles you encountered, many in tracking down the story, but one is just outright racism, discrimination against people of Chinese origin, including in some of the eyewitness accounts, the early newspaper accounts. What kind of false narratives, false stories were coming out that you had to sift through to get to the true story?
Well, there were the rumors about them being stowaways, not only stowaways on Titanic, but also that the Chinese passengers had stowed away in lifeboats, that they had hid out there, that that's where they were essentially hiding even during Titanic's voyage. And then also that as soon as Titanic began to sink, they sought some kind of refuge in boats. With the collapsible boats that they escaped on, it's just not possible. It's like trying to pack yourself into a flat-packed piece of IKEA furniture. There were also rumors that they dressed as women to disguise themselves and get on board the lifeboats. And then there was also some talk that they had forced their way onto the lifeboats and that they were threatened at gunpoint to get out, but that they refused to get out. So, you know, a lot of, in the wake of Titanic sinking, there are so many people trying to make sense of it, and the Chinese were just such easy targets. You know, you had women who had lost their husbands, you had children who had lost their fathers, and they're trying to, you know, they're wondering, well, you know, my father isn't here, but, you know, these men are here. Why are they here? How did they survive in a women and children only or women and children first kind of scenario? So a lot of that anguish was directed toward them, and they never had a chance to defend themselves.
Stephen Schweinkert is the author of The Six, The Untold Story of the Titanic's Chinese Survivors. And Tom Fong is the son of Wing Sun Fong, one of the six people who survived the Titanic. Wing Sun later settled here in Wisconsin. Tom, learning all of this, doing your own research, working with Stephen on this, do you feel understanding this part of your father's life helps you understand him a little more in a way that maybe you didn't since he didn't share that story?
Yes, definitely. There are certain things about his nature that I couldn't understand, but after what Stephen found, it sort of makes sense now about his personality, about certain things. He didn't like large crowds really so much, and he didn't really care for like a lot of noise. I remember, you know, when we went family gatherings and things like that, he could only sit so long, and then would leave these family reunions sort of early because I don't think he cared for that all the large crowd noise. I think that was because of his experience on the Titanic that night, of hearing the screams and things like that. So looking back, yeah, it sort of makes sense.
And Stephen, as we wrap up, you've shared a chapter in the Titanic history that I think has been overlooked, ignored for decades. Why was it important for you to share the story of Tom's father and the other Chinese men on the Titanic?
I think the Titanic story is the reason that we're still interested in it more than 100 years after its sinking is that it's a story that people like to put themselves into. They like to imagine, you know, what would I have done on the night? Would I have stepped back from the rail? Would I have given up my seat in the lifeboat? But I think filling in the gaps and filling in the blanks of, especially the experience of third-class passengers, I think that's really a way forward for Titanic research is to bring all of those stories to life. We know a lot about the Americans that were on board, the British that were on board, the Irish that were on board, for example, but we don't really know so much about, you know, people from outside of those areas.
Stephen, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And Tom, thanks a lot for sharing your story.
Thank you.
Stephen Schweinkert and Tom Fong speak next Thursday at Boswell Books Milwaukee, May 31st at the Cozy Inn in Janesville, June 1st at the Wisconsin Maritime Museum.
The Women's U.S. Open Golf Tournament comes to Wisconsin next week at the Erin Hills Golf Course northwest of Milwaukee.
We'll hear from the golf course director and a golf instructor who's competed on the Women's Pro Tour, and we want to hear about your golf experiences.
If you golf, what got you into the sport? Is Wisconsin a good place for golfing? What do you think?
And there's been a boom in women getting into golf in the last few years. Are you part of that story?
Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org or call or text us at 888-642-0232, and we can share your experiences about golf on the air.
We
Wisconsin Today producers include Lauren Cox, Colleen Leahy, and Joe Tarr.
Our technical directors are Jeff Robbins and Sarah Hopeful.
Tim Peterson is managing producer. Dean Knetter is our executive producer.
Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.